Good morning, everybody. Wonderful. We heard that the ambassador was delayed. We're delighted you're here. Thank you for coming, Ambassador. We're delighted. We're delighted here. We're just getting started. Welcome. We're delighted to have Ambassador Barco here. You're doing such a splendid job here in Washington. We're delighted that you're here. And we're all here to give you kisses. I will hang close. It's my turn when I get done. Okay. Welcome. We're delighted that you're all here. This is a really important conference and something I'm personally very, very interested in and committed to. Let me just say a few words of our thinking on this effort. You know, it was only a short 10 years ago when the story narrative on Colombia was this is a failing state. This is a state that is collapsing to a malignant insurgency with very hostile ideas to Western values, that there is an astounding level of violence, terrorism inside the country, that the army, when it meets up against these forces, loses, that it's the urban areas have become isolated because the insurgency has cut off the transit networks, that the drug production is skyrocketing, drug production and trafficking was skyrocketing, and that this really was the successful business of Colombia, that the state is unable to extend its reach into the countryside. You know, and it had no presence in the countryside. The rule of law was essentially collapsing throughout Colombia. That the insurgency was developing deeper roots in the region and took safe harbor in neighboring states. Corruption was the second most successful industry in the country. This was the story. This was 10 years ago, and we've had a dramatic turnaround. Now, nobody's going to stand here to say all problems have been fixed in Colombia. It isn't that, but I think you'd be hard-pressed to find over a space of 10 years an equally successful transition. I think it's dramatic. And it's a product of effective political leadership with a clear strategy. It's a story of a determined conviction on our part that it mattered, that we were going to be engaged with it, that we could make a difference. I mean, now, when we first started this, I talked to Peter about this effort. I said, look, I mean, we are now celebrating our failures left and right. And we do not have a particularly strong story to tell in Afghanistan these days. We've got a very mixed story to tell in Iraq. We should be learning from the successes in foreign policy, not just the failures. We should learn from the failures too. So this was an effort to try to objectively say, what happened here? What happened here and how did it happen? And it's not to be, we're not going to give you a sugar coating. It's not going to be a dream world gauzy Hallmark card moment to talk about Plan Colombia. It isn't that. It's trying to be very objective because this is meant to be about learning from an important episode in people's lives where determined political action made a difference. And it was here, and it was our partners, it was new leadership in Colombia, effective ambassadorial presence in town, linking us together, making it real for all of us. So that we have an awful lot we can learn from this, that we're going to learn together today. I want to thank all of you for coming. I'm glad that, you know, this is for being such a sophisticated country, we certainly are a one-trick pony as a town. We only focus on one problem at a time, you know. I mean, and so we certainly ought to be looking at a broader spectrum And I think this is an enormously important reservoir of ideas that we ought to be bringing to our heart and to think through how we proceed with all kinds of things. So, Peter, thank you for taking this on. Let me turn it to you. You're going to be running this thing. Anything you want to say to make this open? I'm only ornamental here. I don't have any substantive role. But I did want to get started and say thank all of you for coming. Thank you, Peter, for leading this effort. And why don't we turn it to you?
Thank you very much, John. Thank you for coming. Thank all of you for coming as well. Ambassador Barco, a special welcome. We're going to make some comments about the report, its scope, and its comparative significance, and then open the floor to questions. We're going to begin with our colleague, Dr. Anthony Cordesman, who will be the moderator of the panel, who brings a wealth of understanding of other parts of the world, very conflictive parts of the world, to this discussion that have pertinence to the Colombia issue, and Colombia has pertinence to them as well. So we'll start with Ambassador Cordesman. I'm sorry, Dr. Cordesman, and then I just gave him a... It's the only title he probably doesn't have. Maybe he does. And then we'll make some other comments and then look for your questions, because I know you'll have plenty. Tony?
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Peter asked me to try to take an excellent report and put it in the context of other cases, and particularly the problems we face in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And John gave an important point in his introduction. We are looking in Afghanistan and Iraq at what, in many ways, are worst cases. It is often said that counterinsurgency is remarkably difficult, challenging, and takes forever. In practice, when you really look at the history of insurgencies, it often is remarkably quick. States act very decisively, and insurgencies fade or die in a matter of months. Why? Because the state is capable of taking coherent action. It functions at the civil and political level. It has a working economy. And it can rapidly take what are budding insurgent movements and suppress them. Colombia is a mixed case. It is a warning that if you do face a case where you not only are dealing with insurgency, but with the problems of nation building, you often are talking about the need for strategic patience. As the report points out, this in many ways began in the mid-60s or earlier. It reached a steadily rising level of intensity coupled to narcotics in the 80s and 90s. You had, as you did in Afghanistan, a movement which became associated with a very different ideology with drugs. And you basically began to see coherent action to deal with this only in the late 1990s. Now, this is not an exception. There was a recent study by RAND which made the point, and again, I want to distinguish this word armed nation building from coin. When a country's institutions and economy and social structure are sufficiently weak and divided, you are doing far more than counterinsurgency in the narrow sense. In the RAND study, it pointed out that in the average case where the government wins since 1945, the length of the insurgency was 14 years. That is an issue to keep very closely in mind when you talk about Iraq, which people describe as somehow having been won, but which is a decade away from security and stability, or when you talk about Afghanistan and ask what you can do in 12 to 18 months. These are historical realities, and strangely enough, policymakers, when they confront history, almost inevitably lose. the historical precedent almost inevitably wins. In the case here, Colombia took some 44 years to get from the rise of the FARC to the present. And the point I would raise here is one way to win is to act patiently and react over time, and a very quick way to lose is to seek quick and decisive solutions and become frustrated when they immediately fail or quickly fail. Colombia, like Afghanistan and Iraq, also illustrates the sheer complexity of this. You can't win in the military dimension. You can't win in the civil dimension. You can't win in the political or the ideological dimension. You can't win from the outside, and you can't win from fixing the economy. You have to do the best you can in virtually all of these, knowing that in every area you will face significant compromises and progress will be slow and take time. Again, complexity is not one of our strengths as a country. In fairness, it's not anybody's strength. But if you do not address these issues with the complexity they require, you inevitably are going to vastly increase your problems. I do have to say Colombia is radically different from Afghanistan and Iraq. We share much more in terms of common values. We have much more in common in terms of culture, and we have a large pool of people in the United States with the language skills and area skills that we do not have in Iraq or Afghanistan. It is also a fact that we have had, and I will get to this later, more unity of effort. One thing that is rather striking about the case study in Colombia is if you contrast the consistency of the U.S. effort over time in Colombia with the consistency of the U.S. effort in Iraq and Afghanistan. The report makes the point that this consistency in Colombia was relative, to put it mildly. We did change policies. We had to adapt. We did make mistakes, and the report documents them. But what is really striking is to see the level of consistency in the U.S. effort in Colombia versus the lack of that consistency in Iraq and Afghanistan. One key measure that people fail to address again and again is simply the flow of money and program efforts. If you compare the flow of U.S. funding to Colombia and the way the programs were structured over time, and this is brought out well in the report, it is amazing how erratic the funding in Iraq and Afghanistan was by contrast, particularly when you break it down by individual program area. One thing that is really striking about the U.S. funding profiles in both the Iraq War and the Afghan War is the sheer lack of any coherence, consistency from year to year, vast swings in program funding in individual areas, chronic underfunding in others, and an almost total lack of integration between the civil and military efforts at both the funding and program management levels. These are lessons which are just basic lessons in managing federal programs. But as in Vietnam, in both Afghanistan and Iraq, there was a tendency for each year to be the new year. Each year we brought new concepts at a radically different level in Iraq and Afghanistan until the surge in Iraq. And one of the grim lessons of Afghanistan this summer was we were reinventing Afghanistan for the eighth time without any clear management structure, resource plans, or even campaign plan. Colombia was lucky. And why? Not simply on a funding level or management level, because it was still an operating government or host country. And this is one of the lessons of armed nation building and counterinsurgency that often is ignored. The quality of your partner or the host country, its leadership, and its ability to take the initiative and use outside aid is absolutely critical to success. When you look at the wide range of counterinsurgencies that are defeated, and defeated quickly, what is the key? It isn't outside aid or the U.S. training or U.S. funding. It is inevitably how well the host country behaves, how well it reacts, whether the institutions are there for governance to exist, whether you have an army, a police force, a civil service you can build on. In the case of Iraq, as you know, we disbanded the military, and it took years to rebuild. What is often lost is, in the process, we also disbanded much of the Iraqi civil service and took years to rebuild it, and then tried to rebuild it in our own image. In Afghanistan, there was not a functioning army to really disband. But what many people who worked in Afghanistan are aware of, and many outside Afghanistan are not, and what makes such a sharp contrast to this report on Colombia, is there are about 240,000 Afghan civil servants still working in Afghanistan when we invaded, and we forgot to pay them for the first year of our aid program, which meant they ended up as drivers, translators, working for the United Nations. In effect, the United States and the other countries in the alliance destroyed much of the remaining structure of Afghanistan by neglect, and we are still paying for the consequences, since one of the key problems is government capacity. And if you look through the report, I think what is so striking is the fact that President Uribe was able to build on a structure for all of its weaknesses, which was far more coherent. One of the keys was that you were able to build on an army that did exist. There was a leadership, a structure to reinforce. When you have to zero base the construction of an army, as we did in Afghanistan or Iraq, recreate the entire structure, create whole new combat units, the task is immeasurably more difficult. The need for outside advisors goes up by an order of magnitude. You must embed U.S. or allied forces in every single small unit to be effective. You must provide partner units. You have to provide enabler units. Much of the McChrystal request, much of our presence in Afghanistan is essentially embeds and advisors. And you also are creating a structure where if you do not have a functioning police or civil service, someone must be present in the field. And one of the problems in both Iraq, where most civil aid groups essentially left, aside from those directly involved in the military efforts and PRTs, or Afghanistan, where almost all of the civil effort is irrelevant to the counterinsurgency because it is not present in a threat area or has nothing to do with the needs of the people where insurgents are present, has been so critical that, for example, about 90% of the people actually in U.S. PRTs in Afghanistan, one way or another, are in uniform. It's also rather striking that if you look at the U.S. funding profile, as put out in the State Department figures, since we have been in Afghanistan, 5% of the U.S. aid program has gone to the PRTs, which is, in many ways, a drastic warning of the decoupling of aid and the civil effort from the war you're actually fighting. Building the police is a common lesson in Colombia, the national police, in the effort to create a force that could survive in an insurgency was absolutely critical to success. I think the report makes that point very clearly. In both Afghanistan and Iraq, our efforts to build the police lagged several years behind the start of our effort to build the military, which lagged several years behind the rise of the insurgency. The cost of that in both cases was extraordinarily high. In Afghanistan, the denial of the need for the paramilitary forces which worked in Colombia led to a situation where the Germans tried to train a regular police which served no known purpose for half a decade. We then put the effort under the U.S. State Department, which failed. We put it under the U.S. military, which basically took a year to realize its programs were not properly structured and funded. And we are now again in a salvage effort called the Focused District Development Program, which may or may not work, and is implemented in Afghanistan this year after 8 years for the first time to create the police effort that was a key to Colombia's success from the start. This is a pretty clear lesson. It is repetitive, and it is also still ignored in a great deal of U.S. literature. We are still trying to create regular police forces, according to much of the doctrine for nation building, in spite of the fact they have failed virtually every place anyone has ever attempted to do this under counterinsurgency conditions. If no other lesson here is critical from Colombia, that's one. But there's another. Colombia had still and was able to preserve the cadres of rule of law. In both Iraq and Afghanistan, we attempted to zero base the implementation of rule of law, introducing new practices, new legal codes, and in the case of Afghanistan, trying to introduce a formal legal system from the top down, in spite of the fact the country relied on informal legal systems. That made the effective use of police and rule of law almost impossible. It also made it extremely difficult to carry out counterinsurgency. One thing that's clear, it took time, but by the time we became involved in Colombia, there was a focus on the population and on the territory and not on trying to win kinetic clashes. We still were essentially tactically oriented in Afghanistan through the spring of this year. 8 years on, we were not trying to secure the population, and we were basically not attempting to secure the territory where most people lived, which is one of the key shifts recommended in the McChrystal report. It was not until the surge in Iraq that we focused on the population broadly and on territory broadly. And it is important to remember our success did not occur because of the surge. It occurred because the surge occurred with an uprising among the Sunni tribal groupings in the West, which spread broadly for domestic reasons. It occurred because Sadr's movement to some extent imploded internally, and there was no major threat in the south from the Shiites. And it occurred because the Sunni threat to both Shiite and Kurd kept Kurd and Shiite together long enough so we did not have an Arab-Kurdish problem in the middle of this issue. The tendency to forget this problem has not helped. And the coherence in Colombia, although I think most Colombians might see that differently, was a critical value. Some other lessons that I think come out clearly. Civil rights follow security. They do not precede security. And for all of the focus of human rights organizations on the problems that occur inevitably in a counterinsurgency environment, a focus on the abuses of governments that ignores the level of the homicide rate in the report, of kidnappings, extortion, civil violence, the creation of hostile militias. These are issues which critically affect people in Iraq still. They affect Afghans throughout the country. The problem is not where NATO and ISAF are fighting. When you look at the levels of violence that affect the Afghan forces and police, that area is about 6 to 8 times higher than the areas where there are kinetic clashes with NATO-ISAF forces. If you look at the maps of penetration by Taliban and other networks into areas where there is extortion, attacks on tribal leaders and other areas, that now is about 40% of Afghanistan. And yet, when we were talking about this country this spring, Afghanistan, we were saying that there are only 13 out of 364 districts where we faced a major threat. Why? Because the threat was measured purely as to whether they were attacking NATO-ISAF forces. Go back and look at the speeches in U.S. government reporting, and you can see the difference. A key lesson I found out of this report was the early focus on the people and the agricultural sector and dealing with where the insurgency was. We still have not reached that point with about 80% of the aid effort in Afghanistan. It is focused on post-conflict reconstruction in mid-war, or it is focused on aid that never really reaches the country. We have talked about a strategy now after 8 years in Afghanistan of shape, clear, hold, and build. What is rather striking about this report is that the core of the report focuses on roughly that same strategy from the start in Colombia. We still can't even define what hold and build means in a collective way for the United States government. There is absolutely no one in the State Department who can show you a plan for Afghanistan which indicates what the State Department will do as part of the hold and build phase. After 8 years of war, that is not an impressive result to have in the U.S. government, and it makes a very sharp contrast to the report. Unity of effort. I don't think Colombia would necessarily feel blessed by the fact it only had one major ally, the United States. But Colombia might want to consider what a coalition of the willing did in Iraq. Fortunately for us, much of the coalition left, which allowed us to act on a somewhat coherent basis. In NATO, ISAF, we have 42 countries in Afghanistan, which might politely be described as a coalition of the impossible. Four of them occupy major parts of the country where their inaction, national caveats, and limits create major problems for effective and coherent action and essentially empower the enemy. Out of 42 nations, a maximum of 16 are actually relevant, and the coordination problems with even the 16 are serious. If we're going to play this game, we have to play it with people who want to win and are willing to act accordingly. If there's a lesson, and it's an oblique one from Colombia, it is never go to war again with an alliance of the willing. Go to war with an alliance of the effective. Because war is not a game or an exercise in political symbolism. The last point I'd raise is narcotics. The report tries, I think, to state that we have made real progress in Colombia. And I think we have, if we compare it to what has happened in Afghanistan. But at the end of it, what it also documents is a U.S. approach to the war on drugs, which took years to move from eradication and spraying to a focus on working with the people, providing them alternative livelihoods, and which never had the coherence or effectiveness it should have had from the start. Eradication in Afghanistan has been of immense aid to the Taliban. Our reports that we have drug-free areas in Afghanistan are little more than rubbish. Anybody who visits any of those districts and provinces knows this simply isn't true, and it certainly does not reflect the level of narco-trafficking and narco-activity in areas that are supposed to be drug-free. But by and large, we succeeded magnificently in pushing open opium raising into the southern areas controlled by the Taliban. We didn't affect street price. We didn't affect export supplies, but we pushed actual drug growing into an area where it financed the enemy. The only sign we have as yet of a decline in output in Afghanistan occurred this year, and it was driven largely by oversaturation of the market and a 40% cut in farm gate price in Afghanistan simply because we were producing so much opium in Afghanistan that the market began to collapse and other forms of agriculture became more successful. We still have not been able to move aid teams or any kind of alternative effort into Afghanistan of the kind we saw in Colombia. Why? Because we don't have anybody to actually implement an alternative livelihood program because we don't have aid workers in most of the threatened areas because they don't like to go into places where they get killed. Beyond that, I would have to say what bothers me about the whole argument here is looking at this over 50 years of the war on drugs, there are only two metrics which actually matter in drug conflicts. One is there been a major change in street price? And that is not of a given type of drug. Because if substitutes like synthetics or cocaine is traded against heroin, it is absolutely pointless to win in the case of one drug if you haven't won in the case of the others. But in half a century, we haven't won consistently in the case of any drug. The street price in the United States and Europe simply hasn't been affected by any given battle or activity. The second is, have you reduced demand? And again, demand is net use for drugs, not any one drug. I am impressed by what happened in some of the areas. I am particularly impressed by the efforts in Colombia in some areas to create a province or a specific area to look at alternative livelihood. But let me say on the narcotic side, it is time that as a country and a government, we stopped using absolutely pointless metrics like the dollar value in street prices of seizures in the United States when they have absolutely no impact on supply, demand, or net street price. It is time we stopped using estimates of crop growth, which, as the report on Colombia points out, have historically had no validity and have been proven consistently wrong and required constant calibration. And above all, we need to have much more honest models of what we mean when we talk about counter-narcotics, which look at the overall structure of narcotics pricing and usage and international flows rather than country or crop-oriented structures. I think that all of these points are absolutely critical to what is the world we are going to live in, to the fact we are fighting two wars, and to the almost inevitable reality that our very military strength means opponents have to deal with us asymmetrically or indirectly. And I think this report is a very powerful set of insights in all of these areas. Thank you.
Tony, thank you very much. I'm going to give just a very quick overview of the scope of the report and then ask co-author and my colleague, Johanna Mendelson-Forman, to make comments. I should say that our third author, Phil McLean, is unfortunately not with us today. He's in Europe, but he sends his warm regards to all of his friends here in the audience and wishes that he could have been here as we wish he were. This report is focused on the key factors related to Colombia's recovery from the grave crisis of the 1990s, and we're all familiar with the confluence of events that threatened to drag Colombia into extreme instability towards the end of the 1990s. The report examines the recovery, the reasons for it, the return in balance of power in favor of state authority, as Tony was saying, control of territory, infrastructure, above all, the focus on citizen security and on the population, the growth of the armed forces and its quality, including special new units within the armed forces, such as the Home Guards, that had an important role. We talk about the improvements in the size and the quality of the police and new police units that made a difference in controlling territory, strategy, funding, a considerable amount of attention paid to that, mobility. We talk about how Colombia went from approximately 20 functioning helicopters in the armed forces in the late 1990s to now having the third largest Black Hawk fleet in the world, approximately 275 combined Colombian rotary air units. We talk about training, communications, intel. We describe the successes in improving the situation with violence and human rights, the huge declines in mass murders, kidnapping, massacres, trade union homicides, roadblocks, sabotage, the huge jump that resulted in public confidence in Colombia and the support for the government. We talk about the paramilitary demobilization, the very grave threat that paramilitarism posed to Colombian society and how that was carried out. In our analysis of drugs, we focus on our conclusions on the relevance of the drug issue to Colombia more than anything else. And we take the position that the counter-drug efforts in Colombia have been more successful than typically is attributed to those efforts, that the size of the narcotics economy has been substantially reduced, that the amount of money available to insurgents and paramilitaries was also cut substantially. We make some comments about coca cultivation and cocaine potential production, which are measurements that are frequently used to determine whether or not a drug campaign is a success. And we point out that those are not necessarily either reliable standards of measurements and weren't reliably measured in Colombia and perhaps shouldn't be used as standards anyway. We talk about U.S. support, which overall was quite positive in the case of Colombia. We talk about the remarkably small footprint that the United States has had in Colombia, which was really quite extraordinary and extremely effective. Lots of different variables there that I won't go into. You can read about them in the report. We talk about alternative development and when alternative development can work. Even the term alternative development, in our view, needs to be reexamined. It is extremely difficult for any kind of meaningful economic life to take place in a conflict zone, in an area where narcotic drugs are being grown, where people have the option of growing narcotics as opposed to some other kind of crop. And clearly the shift that's been seen over time in the strategy of the Colombian government and the United States to concentrate resources in areas where a sustained growth can take place once security is in place with a sequencing of security, of counter-drug activities, and of development activities so that there is a coherence and a sustainability to the process. We include in our report a very brief case study of the Macarena region in Colombia where such an effort is taking place. And finally, we underscore the importance of the rule of law as a factor that is absolutely essential to Colombia and moving ahead. It's one of the weaknesses of Colombia. It's a traditional weakness in Colombia. It's one that requires an extraordinarily more concentrated attention, one that both the United States, but above all, Colombia needs to focus on. Johanna, the floor is yours for your comments as well.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you, Tony, for your comments. And I particularly want to thank Peter for bringing me back to a country that I left 32 years ago when I worked on my doctorate in Colombia and then could never go back because of the violence. But in those years in between when I worked with militaries and worked on what is now called post-conflict reconstruction or nation building, a lot of the commonalities from those experiences came to bear on this report. And I should note, Tony, that the first thing that I think Colombians have addressed very well is something that the Afghan Ashraf Ghani gave to us, and that's the sovereignty gap issue. One of the lessons that have come out of these projects has been that Colombia is now addressing perhaps one of the most important things we've learned in these experiences is that it is now trying to take control of its national territory and having a high rate of success in doing so, though the project is not finished and we're certainly not out of a conflict yet. But things like weak institutions of justice, monopoly on the use of force, provision of infrastructure services, even investment in human capital are moving ahead. And perhaps in comparing this with experiences in other countries that went through conflicts in Latin America, Colombians have made a commitment that security is a public good. And when security becomes a public good, it means that citizens are invested in their own safety and security. And that's something very different than I think that we've experienced even in cases like El Salvador or Guatemala, Nicaragua, where there was a finish to a conflict, there was an accord, but there certainly wasn't the investment of a public understanding the relationship between the state's role of a use of force and the citizens' responsibility to take it. So I think those are some pretty interesting features out of that. I think the other thing are some takeaway lessons that we can use. I was in Iraq. I share some of Tony's concerns about what you see of the lack of coherence. I think the Plan Colombia represents perhaps an implementation of what many of us who worked in conflict zones understand, and that is a whole-of-government approach. It was not just a military project, but it was using the work of other ministries, civilian ministries that worked on agriculture, civilian ministries that worked on social welfare, that came together with the armed forces to create a counterinsurgency plan, and I underscore counterinsurgency, not counter-narcotic plan, that started slowly to integrate the functions of the state into many areas that had been once neglected. So let me just give you some quick other lessons that come out of this, and I think Peter has clearly articulated those chapters in the report, which you can get detail on. But I absolutely think that the security sector reform, the massive reconstruction, rebuilding the Colombian army, will ultimately lead to the goal of greater respect for human rights, because you can't have security without rights, but you have to have the security sector reform first, and that is underway. We also know that the U.S. support was essential, but it didn't overshadow the ownership. And I think this is reinforced again and again in many of the reports we see coming out of Afghanistan and Pakistan. We also understood out of the lesson of Colombia that the insurgents were the enemy of the state and that only the drugs fueled their fighting. The drugs were not the enemy per se. And by shifting that paradigm, the Plan de Consolidación Democrática recognized that shift. It recognized it was the insurgency that had to be fought, even if with the drugs fueling that. And that's where U.S. support was critical, because by providing training and capacity, we were able to help in that situation. And finally, winning hearts and minds, which is the ultimate goal of insurgency, requires these other services. And as Peter referenced, the study on one area of Colombia, other types of aid-related projects are going on there. But it also shows the bankruptcy of alternative development without a sustainability plan. That is now beginning to take place. So where are we in the war right now? Perhaps von Clausewitz said it best. He said, in war, the results are seldom final. And I think that it's probably true that even in a case like Colombia, the situation is more of a tipping point where things look optimistic and there's plenty of room for optimism as long as there is this commitment both of the security sector of the government and the civil sector of the government to work together to bridge a sovereignty gap, which still exists, and also to illustrate that when you have a coherent counterinsurgent strategy and a development strategy working together, you ultimately can get positive results. And I think I'll leave it there.
Joanna, thank you very much. I'd be delighted to answer questions or if anyone has comments in general. Sir?
Is there a microphone?
If you could simply identify yourself and your affiliation.
I'm Tom Reckford with the World Affairs Council and the Malaysia America Society. Sounds like a terrific report. I would like to suggest that what is now Malaysia and Singapore would also be a very good example of a study on counterinsurgency. It did last about what Tony Cordesman said, 14 years. In that case, it required a very strong colonial government, Britain, and an internal security act, which was very effective during the insurgency, but has become quite a problem in peacetime, because both the governments of Malaysia and Singapore used the internal security act to crush their opposition. There may be lessons for Colombia in this.
Norman Bailey, Institute of World Politics. This is, first of all, a fascinating panel, and I look forward with great pleasure to reading the report. I wonder if any of the panel would like to address the lessons that the success of Plan Colombia may have for what's going on right now in Mexico and Central America and the Merida Initiative.
I think the lessons for Mexico and Colombia are obviously different cases, but there are similarities. Some of the cartel violence going on in Mexico is remindful of Colombia, perhaps back in the 1980s. Fortunately, there is no political insurgency. Paramilitarism is not a factor. But the ability of law enforcement of the armed forces to control territory, control supply routes, control access to financing, flows of cash. These are all critical capabilities in terms of their communications, intelligence, quality of the state security forces. All extremely important. National will, the channeling of national will to take on this kind of a challenge, I think, is key. Colombia, one of the key factors was the support that Colombians gave to their government, both in terms of their willingness to spend money to actually pay for these important upgrades in their security. And what's interesting is that we tend to think the United States was spending so much in Colombia. In fact, the Colombian part was much larger than the U.S. even in the security side throughout. So if you want security, you want improvements, you got to pay for it. You got to have the political will. Johan?
think, Norman, your question is very important, and I think there are lessons that overlap. Certainly the inability to really have a police force that is not corrupted is a challenge that Colombia still faces, and it still faces. Mexico is, as you know, riddled with the problem of a weak security sector, not so much the armed forces, but the use of an armed forces for an internal security problem, of course, begins the whole downslide. I think the other comparative issue which Colombia didn't face is that Mexico is at our border, and the porosity of that border is a challenge. I think Colombia faces that right now in that it faces a border with Venezuela, where we know that there has been ample cross-border supplies of illicit problems. But I think the bigger issue for both Colombia and Mexico is these are transnational problems, and that one policy for Colombia or one policy for Mexico is not going to resolve the corrupting and insidious role of drug trafficking. And it begs a bigger study that the United States has to do with its allies, because we're all victims of the same problem.
Thank you. Madam Ambassador.
So I want to start by congratulating you. As always, your studies are always very insightful, and we appreciate it as a country. We appreciate your views, because it really allows us to see what we're doing, and they're always very thoughtful and so thorough. I think one of the things that your study leads us to look at now is also the role that Colombia can play also as a facilitator and sharing its experiences. We need to look at what we've done in Colombia, and this is what we're doing now with Mexico. We're training about 1,000 police. We're working with Guatemala. We sent a group over to Haiti. We're working not only with MINUSTAH, but we one of our colonels spent 45 days looking there. And what becomes interesting is, since we're a country that suffered this problem, we have certain credibility as becoming trainers that were trained and have lived through the experience, which will allow us to work forward. So I think this is another view, and that's why your kind of analysis that allows us to look at what we're doing, where we still have problems, but also we're trying to do these analysis to see how we can help. And I think this becomes important because it is transnational. And we need to be very worried about what's happening in Central America, what's happening in the Caribbean, what's happening with the countries in Africa. And the U.S. and Europe, we have to look at this together. It's not one drug. It isn't an American problem or a European problem. It really is a problem that we need to keep on looking at. And I think it's the biggest challenge we have to our democracy and to our society. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Ambassador. Question here?
Thank you. Maria McFarland from Human Rights Watch. I haven't read the report, so maybe when I read it I'll find that these discussions addressed there. But I want to press you a little bit on the issue of the numbers. Mm-hmm. I think it's a little risky to be selective in which indicators we look at. Certainly, homicides and kidnappings have dropped, and I think the pressure on the FARC has helped tremendously with that. Massacres dropped. As early as 2002, it was part of a shift of tactics by the paramilitaries. But other types of abuses have not dropped. The use of landmines, for example, by the FARC has gone up, in part because they're under pressure. And the number that intrigues me the most is the rate of internal displacement. The fact is that more than 250,000 Colombians still become internally displaced every year. And since 2004, that number has actually been rising every year, according to official statistics. Most of those people are displaced because they're threatened. Historically, those threats have come primarily from paramilitary groups. And nowadays, it appears they're mostly coming, or a substantial share of it is coming, from new armed groups that appeared in the wake of the paramilitary demobilization. The police, which has the most conservative numbers on membership of those groups, is saying that they have more than 4,000 members. They're in 24 out of the country's 32 departments. I've been traveling to the country 6 times a year, researching this issue for a while now, and I consider it a pretty serious threat to human rights and the humanitarian situation in the country. So I'd be interested in hearing your reaction to that.
Well, thank you very much. Indeed, we do talk about the increased use of landmines by the FARC as a defensive tactic. The more their military capability is degraded, the more they use landmines, and also as a way of trying to kill manual eradicators to discourage that. Internal displacements, we don't go into a lot of discussion of it, but we do flag it as an ongoing problem. The new emerging groups we discuss, we talk about who they are, where they're coming from, and we talk about how the Colombian government needs to pay particular attention to making certain that this does not reach the stage in which it becomes a national security rather than more of a law enforcement issue. The paramilitary demobilization, there are several pages about that, and we talk about the problems that have arisen from it and the extremely complex issue. The whole issue of paramilitarism in Colombia, which is a grave threat to democracy and to the country in general, it gets a certain amount of attention because it's a key security factor in our report.
I share everything Peter says. One thing about landmines, and I'd be interested in Tony's comment on this. One of the problems of the Internet is the fact that you can see insurgencies using all kinds of anti-personnel devices going viral. And I think the use of these anti-personnel weapons in Colombia, which is relatively new, seemed to me the access to watching things happen in other parts of the globe and looking at how effective they are as scare tactics. I don't know if that's actually true because I haven't seen or been in FARC territory where they actually use it, but I can't imagine that they're ignorant, knowing that they have computers and can see these things about how perilous the use of these devices are, and people fear them. And you use them, you put landmines down, you kill children, you kill civilians. And I believe some of that is coming, in many ways, from a viral nature of the global nature of terrorism. How we stop that is another issue. But it's very new in Colombia. It wasn't, I mean, in the hand eradication areas, it's new. And that's, I mean, the use of anti-personnel is not, Colombia is one of the heaviest mined countries in the world. But that is not the issue right now. So, I mean, I think we should pursue it. It's a very important question.
I think you do see a different pattern, but it's the same general result. What you see in Afghanistan and Iraq as groups come under pressure, they go to large-scale bombings, vehicle-borne vehicles. These also become more and more directed at the population, attempting to produce publicity, attempting to get coverage, attempting to exploit fault lines, or simply create a set of social disorder that will somehow allow the insurgency to recover or to deflect. And unfortunately, landmines, for example, in a place like Afghanistan are being replaced by IEDs. And these don't produce the same patterns as yet of random violence in fields or areas where people move outside road systems, but more and more of these are beginning to be directed in ways where they're automatic, where they're left behind, and they do indeed impact on ordinary people, with the end result that, basically speaking, they're being killed, and often in ways where there's no count, because nobody really in these countries has a homicide count. We may get one in Iraq over the next few months, but outside Baghdad province and other areas, it's still somewhat problematic. And as for Afghanistan, we can spot areas of activity, but we have no casualty numbers whatsoever that have the slightest validity.
We're honored to have the Vice Minister of Defense of Colombia with us today, Sergio Jaramillo.
If I may just make a few quick points about the very interesting comments made by Dr. Poulsen and the panel. And thank you first, as the Ambassador said, for the report. It's actually for us very interesting to have an outside look on lessons learned from Colombia, including the things that, you know, good lessons and bad lessons, and this is all a process. Plan Colombia was in 10 years, and I think we've learned a lot. Four quick points on lessons learned, on one on the problem, on the government strategy, on the metrics, and on U.S. support. It seems to me that the Colombian situation is particularly relevant in the current discussion on Afghanistan and so forth. Being very different countries for obvious reasons that you all know, still the set of problems is similar. You have a serious problem with an insurgency, serious problem with a drug economy, from a sanctuary, and finding a way of doing this at the same time is not an easy thing to solve. It seems to me that in the U.S., much progress has been made on what we call the coin side. So the army has now coin doctrine, and everyone knows about veteran population and so forth. It seems to me that the other side, the counter-narcotics, is less well understood. And it's not a discussion about eradication. It's the key point that a drug economy or an insurgent group, when they're running it, which is the case of the FARC, and it seems to me from a distance, increasingly possibly the case of the Taliban, is also a form of control. So it has to be all part of one effort. And finding the solution to that is actually not an easy conundrum to solve. What have we done? Well, we first laid out a strategy. Obviously, the base of all of this was leadership, the leadership of President Duterte. But then we clearly laid out that the priority was for population protection in 2002. Doesn't mean we haven't had problems, including serious human rights problems, but we have them, we've acted promptly. And then the two key ideas were territorial control and government coordination. Now, that is easy to say. In practice, it actually took us quite a long time to get the system going, because the military and the police, they react quickly when you point them in one direction. The civilian government is more difficult to organize. But I think we're finally coming up with solutions like the ones you kindly visited in the pilot program in the Macarena, where we actually find a model for integrating efforts in a successful way to deal with both problems at once. Because it really is all, this is our point of view, our little contribution would be to say it's all really one problem. You can't distinguish the drugs from the insurgency. You have to deal with both at the same time. On the metrics, just small point of dissent with Dr. Poisson, because he says that the only relevant metrics are street price and reduction of demand. That's probably, well, certainly true from the U.S. point of view. From our own point of view, it's just as relevant. What is the impact of this narcotics trade on the rule of law in Colombia, and how can we actually reduce that? And I think there we have made great progress. That said, I do think the issue of the metrics has been a problem historically, and by we have suffered from, here I speak perhaps as an individual, from not using quite the right metrics. So from the beginning of Plan Colombia, the obsession with hectares eradicated was not helpful. And we're still suffering from that in our own system, because convincing parts of our own system to not just think about inputs but outputs, to think about zones that are free of coca and not just how many coca hectares be eradicated. Those are actually the day-to-day problems of fixing the system. But it is working. Quick point on the point made by Barilla on internal displacement. The truth is that there are no good figures on internal displacement. It's extremely difficult to know what's going on, and it's extremely difficult to know how many people are really currently displaced for various reasons. The nature of displacement has changed qualitatively. We have very little what is called in Spanish massive displacement, and we have more individual displacement. And we don't yet understand well enough what's behind us. On the other hand, if I may add an anecdote, precisely about the program you visited in this integrated program in this growing area, far from Seoul, in the Macarena. We were out there in a village a month ago, and we were talking to the people who were running the program there, and they said we had now a big problem because we had done a kind of what are called transition plans with 600 families of that village, include security, food support, trying to organize some of their guarantees of an income. And suddenly we found we had twice as many. We now have 1,200, which we hadn't expected. And the reason why that's the case is because the people who had been displaced had heard that they could now, the security situation was such, and there were such programs that they could actually start coming back. So there's a trickling back to those areas which we haven't quantified. So we don't really know what's going on. But we are concerned, the President is concerned, we've actually had special meetings with the ICRC to look at this rather closely. Last point about U.S. government support, where I do think there are a lot of lessons, and I think Susan here, rightly from the IID, can tell you even more, but just a few quick ones. One is, you need a government plan. It's true that Plan Colombia on paper was a whole of government approach, but when it first started, it is not quite true that there was a proper integrated plan of a Colombian government. So if you review what happened with the resources in the first years, perhaps that it wasn't as effective for that reason, because there was no integration really on the ground between the U.S. effort and what the government was doing. And that is the case now. I mean, that is really now, we really are on the same sheet of music because the government has a program, a plan, and the U.S. government is supporting precisely that plan. It makes a big difference. Second point is, there is agreement, and this is something that Susan always emphasizes, and we're very grateful for that, that this is a plan of the Colombian government. This is something that I personally find always very striking about the aspects of discussion, and that is that it still seems things, the effort is seen as being done in coordination with the Afghan authorities and that sort of thing. So it has to be the Afghan authorities. With us, the agreement now is that anything that happens on the ground, it is the Colombian government. Even if there is USA funding, OCI funding, whatever the program is, it is the Colombian government because it is about getting the support of the people and getting, I was mentioning that yesterday at a talk, even more important sometimes than the actual thing we do is the feeling by the citizens that the government is paying attention, that finally it woke up and got to this place and decided to do something about the situation. And that has to be the government. And there again, I think we've moved in the right direction. Finally, a point about the funding. And that again is that it's not, in the case of Colombia, that has been very generally supported by the U.S., it's not even so much the amounts as the way they have been used. And the flexibility that the funding has given us to do certain things that we couldn't have done on our own. There's a great paradox about these issues of whatever you want to call them. We call them consolidation in the old days. Word that nobody likes anymore, they call them pacification. There's a paradox in that because a government that tries to behave like a serious government, we try to do, has actually, strictly speaking, consolidated its own country because there's a lot of spending that it cannot do because it doesn't have the flexibility. Its own budgetary process and planning process are not made for actually going to a village and asking people what are the 10 things you would build like and then giving them two so you can build trust. We just can't spend money that way. So the programs that the U.S. has brought in, I would mention particularly OTI, that we have been extremely successful. And we are grateful. We hope that we can keep the support going for a while because we're not there yet, but we're sailing in the right direction. Thank you.
I just make first, I think your point is perfectly valid. I was talking about the impact of the war on drugs on the United States, not on Colombia. But I think there are two issues you raise that really do deserve attention. One is the need for an integrated civil-military plan. We don't have that in Afghanistan for obvious reasons. When you have 42 countries and as many countries in charge of the military and PRTs as actually exist in the field, integrated planning is almost impossible. If you look at the McChrystal report, there's a reference to the first U.S. integrated civil-military plan in Afghanistan. After 8 years of war, what it neglects to point out is that the two authors of the plan, which actually had substantive content, ran into enough internal stovepipes in the United States that they both were sent home. This is not exactly a triumph of civil-military planning, even in the major outside government. And here, one of our problems is when you talk about metrics and Afghan authorities, I think what we need to contrast here is Colombia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. By and large, in many areas, there are no Afghan authorities. There are about 143 population clusters in Afghanistan, but there are an almost infinite number of small villages. As nearly as we can figure out, there is no government activity in about two-thirds of the villages, which, strangely enough, leaves them open to Taliban activity. out of the 364 districts, about half have some kind of structured functioning government that moves outside the district building. That is, again, not exactly a central activity. There are Afghan ministries which can do things effectively at the central federal level. But the problem is they control virtually every single bit of the money, and the provincial governors and district chiefs don't have any. And these small understaffed ministries, even when they have integrity and are active, can't operate nationally. Now, why? Partly was the fact that the civil servants were disbanded. God knows what it would have been better with them, but I'm going to assume that would have. But the other is that the outside countries created an extremely centralized government system out of the fear of warlordism and divisions within the country. So now it will be up to the U.S. and the countries out there to try to build what you were able to do in Colombia by going directly from the PRTs and the military to the local governments, to the district governments and the provincial governors, and bypassing the system to give them money where we can directly account for the impact, and bypassing officials that are corrupt or incapable. And at least for several years, that's going to be the development. So when people look at Colombia as a model and then talk about empowering Afghan governance, even the areas that are described as being effective in Afghanistan when you go there often turn out to be people who start projects they don't complete but do not in the process steal the money. You can't use those kinds of authorities. And you have to basically say it isn't enough just to map the enemy and characterize the enemy. You have to map and characterize the host government and know what it's doing, just as you have to map and characterize what UNAMA's aid teams and NATO ISAF countries are doing. And if any of you can find a description of the national caveats and restrictions on the individual NATO countries, which is public, or find any UNAMA report which covers the subject of how the aid is used in Afghanistan, please do send me the reference. I'm sure all of us would be greatly enthused to find it.
There's time for one more question. Ed, do you have a question?
Edward Tate, I'm the Executive Director of the Pan-American Health and Education Foundation, formerly with USAID, where I was the director in Colombia in the early 90s, and then in Mexico, 2007. And I wanted to go back to this question of comparisons with Mexico. From my view, we seem to be going down the same road. Neither the Mexican government nor the U.S. government taking advantage of the tremendous successes that Colombia has achieved to try to instruct how the assistance is going to be provided in Mexico and how the Mexican government is going to act. Heavy emphasis on the side of police training, armed forces, and on the part that is on controlling the problem, and very little, it seems to me, on the economic side, which has to get at the problem of where the narcotics trafficking and production is taking place, and how you try to counter that activity with some economic activity. I'm wondering whether CSIS has in mind perhaps having a conference where they try to bring together the successes of Colombia to compare them to what the success in Mexico is.
Yeah, no, I think, Ed, that's a perfectly valid point. And one of the things we've been doing quietly, because the report hadn't been released, is actually proposing that. And we'd welcome, from your perspective, also other partners, because we think, like Ambassador Barco said, Colombia has a lot to teach other countries of the region, and it's not too early to start.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Thank you all very much for having come. Our report will be available as we speak online at the CSIS website. Again, I'd like to thank the panelists and thank you all. We look forward to comments you may have on the report and to continuing to discuss the case of of Colombia and its pertinence elsewhere as we try to solve some of these difficult problems. Thanks very much.